I guess this is something we also do in yeshiva, and we have Amlava Malka every few weeks. And what I do is I speak on a biography of a gadol who's I started with somebody whose yahrzeit would be the following month. We ran out of people whose yahrzeit I could identify, and he also realized that there are about 6 months a year when I couldn't do it, so we're going more in chronological order. So one of the challenges in history and biography is finding facts and tying them together. So it's one thing somebody lived the last 50 years, 100 years, and you have a lot of people wrote. When you go back in time, it's very, very hard to get really material that's reliable. If somebody today picks up a pen and writes about the Rambam, the question is, how do you know it? And where did you get it from? And unfortunately, anything that's Baal Peh is not reliable, because a story changes every time you say it, and the so-called known stories, most of them have no shayches. So the things that so I try to tell people where I got my information from, and it's the second problem is, people, academics, look for facts, but you're building a story. You're not, a telephone book is the most accurate factual record of a city. It's worth nothing as a story. You have to make the story. So putting the pieces together depends on the person's predisposition, on his attitude and so on. That's why it's extremely difficult. But just try to do what we can and so on, so that we can sketch out history and so on. The person that I wanted to speak about, whose turn is Rabbeinu Gershom, and he is a foundational figure for Ashkenaz Jewry. Even Sfardim can be nice about him. And there is very little known about him. Now, everybody knows the story of why he asked the two wives. There's a problem with that story. The source is Rabbi Marcus Lehmann. He was a person who did wonders. German Jews, in his time, knew nothing. He wrote novels for kids to read so that they get a lot of ideas and facts and words and so on. It was not an attempt to be a history in any sense of it. People don't realize it. It was a Chashva Talmud Chacham, and this was an amazing enterprise that kids, instead of reading about German fairy tales, they would read about all sorts of mythical Jewish figures. So he would have names that he would drop, and he would build a story around it, and which is wonderful, but it's not history, it's not biography. So his whole story at Rabbeinu Gershom, there's no fact to it. The fact is, yes, so kids learned there was somebody named Rabbeinu Gershom. They learned he was very important. They learned he made Yisurim. They learned that. Those were things, but the whole story of it is no fact, and he never claimed that's based on anything. But it came in people's... So I'll try a little bit. Where's the best source of information that I found? There was a person died a few years ago. His name was Rabbi Shapansky, Rabbi Saul Shapansky. His son was my chavrusa in the Mir, and he's a Roshiva today in the Mir in New York. And he wrote, he was a scholarly person, he was a Talmud Chacham, a scholarly person. And he wrote Hatakanas B'Yisrael. That's a 3 or 4 volumes of all Takanas from the Gemara on afterwards. A scholarly work of great quality. And Rabbeinu Gershom is obviously an important figure, and he basically is probably the last person that sums up everything that's known about him, which is not much. And he also has all the Takanis and all the supposed Takanis and so on and so forth. And he discusses it, whatever shittas there are, whatever day is, whatever arguments and so on and so forth. But that's I found that to be the best, because he's the latest, most information, and is all and it's laid out in the Prezes Talmud Chacham. In the back of the Encyclopedia Talmudis, they have on the section of Cherem and Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, they have a huge addendum in the back. It doesn't have any historical or biographical material, but it discusses the Cherem and so on and so forth. So where did he live and what was his where does he stand in Jewish history? So the Golos, we spoke about Golos now, Klal Yisrael was kicked out of Eretz Yisrael. Bavel was by far and large the most important community out. There was something in Mitzrayim at different times, but Bavel was the most important part. There was later in North Africa, and that's where the Gaonim lived. And that was the hundreds from the Gemara onwards until close to the end of the millennium. That was pretty much where we lived. Then they began migrating outwards in two directions. Spain, obviously, that's west. Everybody was Mekayim, go west, young man. The question was it directly west or northwest? Italy became the next station. That's the next north. And from Italy, people migrated to France and to Germany. And there were no countries in those days. It was a lot of little fiefdoms of different types. But that's where it went. So that's where Ashkenaz Jewry came from. The migration northwards from Italy upwards, that was the beginning of what we would call Ashkenaz communities. They settled in Germany along the Rhine, France, and that area. And that became really the bedrock for a German Ashkenazi Jewry, which was in France and in Germany. Rabbi Gershom was born something like 960, not clear. He died in 1028. His Matseva is still around in a museum in Berlin. For whoever's planning the next trip, museum in Berlin might be a good place to go. We have that. And we have the ksuba of his second wife also. He had remarried, and that ksuba we have. It's a ksuba d'Irkus, actually, and that's also around. Those are the two artifacts we have of that. So he lived in that area, and at the turn of the millennium, that's where he lived. The Marshal writes in a place that he was a Talmud of Reb Haigon. So that would connect him. Reb Haigon was pretty much a contemporary of his. He was born a little earlier, died a little later. Reb Haigon lived a long time, but pretty much they overlapped. We don't have a record that they really connected. We don't know if he means it was a Talmud of his literally, or just that he follows the Masoros of the Gaonim. But in Jewish history, this was a turning point. Gaonim had their own style of leadership. It was focused around a yeshiva, which was sort of a central institution. They had their way of learning, which was also uniquely theirs. They were almost a continuation of Gemara. They really gave back and forth and reasons. They basically said pretty much like the Masoros how they got things. That, you know, this is how our Masoros into yeshivas. Most of the Gaonim, when they wrote this, there are no back and forth and lengthy. That's if we're going with the beginning of German-French Jewry with the Bali Tosfos, with the beginning of Spanish Jewry, and you know with the Rishonim, you began to have a whole new style of learning. So this was a pivotal point in history. Rabbeinu Gershom, we have a pirush on Gemaras, different Gemaras that on the side is written Rabbeinu Gershom. And it's very similar to Rashi. And Rashi Ukozhny will quote. Now, it's not clear if it's really Rabbeinu Gershom. I want to explain this. All of these things were written in manuscripts. The manuscripts do not look like books with like, you know, Chidush Rabbeinu Gershom al Hashas, printed by this person, sponsored by Asher Publication, or something like that. It doesn't look like that at all. It's a manuscript. And it's copied and recopied, and somebody has bits and pieces. The people who made the Shas that we have made a concerted effort to find very good manuscripts and things that they could publish. It was actually a non-Jewish person, a good businessman, and he realized Jews like Sfarim, and he was the one who really put together a team that did it. So they found these type of manuscripts that they felt would go well, that are important. Now, it's very hard to print something and write Chidush Leneda Lemi 1, Chidush Leneda Lemi 2, Chidush Leneda 3. There's a limit to how many Leneda Lemis you could have. So they would attribute it to you know, there would be all sorts of clues. Ad Kan Rabbeinu Gershom. So it is from Rabbeinu Gershom's Cheder. In other words, it's him, it's his Talmidim, or possibly the other way around. Like possibly there were, it was a base medrash, they have names for it. It was Magensia, Chidushim. It did revolve around him, but we're not sure that that's his. Directly. Again, this is either Talmidim of his or colleagues of his, Rebbeim plus him, but it's his, and it's the first, it's a Pirush that is kind of reminiscent of Rashi, much more brief, much less explained, but it's a type of Pirush, which in the Gonim you don't find. This was a Pirush on the Gemara. You don't find in the Gonim a Pirush in the Gemara. They shuvas basically, and halacha summations. That's it. That's one thing that we have from him. We have also tshuvas that are quoted in other sfarim. Many of the things that he said or wrote are quoted. Tosfos quotes, other Rishonim quote. So his psukim and so on like that had been quoted in other sfarim. He wrote a piyut, which we say Rosh Hashanah and slichas, Schor Bris, very famous piyut, Ein L'Shir LaTorah Zois. Very famous piyut. That's his piyut, and that became part and parcel of the mainstay of our slichas. We say it in Ne'ilah, we say it in slichas, and so on. Those are things that he that we know that he wrote. There's one more tragic thing that we know about him. The it's brought down in the Mordechai and it's brought down in Halacha. He had a son who converted to Christianity. And it says that he sat 14 days shiva, unclear in the Lashonas that are written as to whether or not it's when he died and he sat a double shiva, or it's just when he converted. But that's brought down, that's written, and so we know that as a fact. We don't know if it was because he was forced under pressure, whatever it is, that's already, it's conjecture. But Lemaisa, we do have it. It is interesting that one of the takanis that the Rebbeinu Gesher made was that you should never remind a person who had converted and did tshuva of his past. That's one of them. Interesting, it was obviously a phenomenon that occurred. It could be it was under a lot of pressure. But whatever it is, it's very interesting. That's one of the things that Rebbeinu Gershom writes. But that's a fact that's mentioned and brought down. And in Halach, it's brought down about a vichiv avelus on someone that Lo'aleinu, you know, was shmat and so on. That's a piece that we have. What he became more famous for, now, he's called Rashi in its tshuvas, calls him the Me'or HaGola, which is incredible. Me'or HaGola means the light of the Golas. Not clear what basis. In other places it says he was Meir Einenu with his Takanis. In some places it says with his Pirushim. But he was recognized as being the Me'or HaGola, which is an extraordinary title. I'm not aware anyone else had that title. But it obviously the fact that he established the Jewish communities in a halachic way in Germany and so on and so forth, means that he put it on foundations that made it viable and so on. He became famous for takanis that he made. Again, we have no original copies of any sefer that lists takanis. We have in later sfarim mention of his takanis, and the most famous reliable place is Marami Rottenberg, who was much later, and he was from the Dole Ashkenaz and the Rebbe of the Rosh and so on, and he lists it in a tshuva, he lists the takanis. There are an extraordinary amount of different and conflicting sources about how many takanis he made, how many takanis were those takanis that he personally made, how many were takanis that were made together with everybody else, how many takanis were old takanis that he just reestablished, and how many takanis were made by people after him, but it just sort of was swept under. The listings are anywhere from, you know, 2 to 3 to 60, 70. We have up to 60, 70 takanis that in one safe or another are listed as attributed to Rebbeinu Gershom. not something that there's any way to clarify it, because it's so vague, and the lashonos are different. Asher tikkun al pi Rabbeinu Gershom, Asher Rabbeinu Gershom v'chaverov tikkunu, and so on and so forth. What was the nidui? What was the cherem? What was this? What was that? Very, very unclear. The takanas range. So in the big picture, they range from things like not marrying to women, which was a big, major undertaking in terms of halacha. It's basically a really kind of, it's not conflicting in Africa, but it's a huge takana. On the other hand, a lot of those takanas, these are the ones that are more credibly his, about when you could stop davening, if somebody has a problem, when you can patch on the bima, when you can't. The takanas that range are very fascinating in the scope of it. A lot of things about shuls, when you can take somebody's safe if it owes you money, when can't you take a safe if it owes you money, and things of that nature, from very big to very small. These takanas are interesting because they also seem to tell us about what was important in those days. You assume that you have only X amount of takanas you could make, and you save them for the most important things. So one type of takana that keeps coming up a lot deals with ma'arufia, which is leasing. Jews made parnasa in those days. This was before they had healthcare, so you needed parnasa someplace else. So the way they had parnasa was they would lease estates from non-Jews. They would lease money. In other words, I'll take a block of X amount of dollars and I'll lend it out in small parcels. They were go-betweens. Now, the money that you paid, so when you lease something, if somebody outbids you, you lose, obviously. So you say, I'm willing to give you for this castle is worth X amount of money per month. Someone else comes and like, give you more than that. So he made, and this is actually many of the Din Torahs brought to Rishonim deal with this topic. This is a topic that's very, very common, and obviously, and he created takanas that you cannot. It's called Hasagas Gvul, and he extended the concept of Hasagas Gvul so that you cannot outbid someone in leasing on the estate and so on and so forth. This obviously dovetails with what we know of those tkufis, that this was a major source of parnasa. If you would allow people to bid wildly, it would kill it for everybody. And b'meila, they made a takanas as a successful. In terms of ishus, the famous one is not to give a get bal karchach and not to take two wives. It's debated as to what was the reason. This is why Marcus Lehman had a whole story built around an unhappy marriage of his with two women. There's no base for that. But the question was, what was the reason? What would happen, manishtana, that now it became a problem? One interesting proposal by Kadmainim is that since the Gentiles were Christian, they did not take two wives. The Jews looked like they were scorned because they're doing something primitive like that. And that's why those living in the Muslim countries, there was no Xerah, they didn't say it wasn't, the Muslims took many wives, so that was fine. And this, that, I don't know, we don't have any record of it, we don't know why, but those are the two of this famous takanis in terms of issues. So you do not give a get bal karchach, and you do not take two wives. An interesting question that arose is, if Bezin, so there is a mechanism, there are mechanisms, Hetemei Rabbanim, which I'll discuss in a minute, and if there's a time of an onus of some sort, they matter it. So let's say you have a woman who's incapacitated and totally, and in a coma or something, Chas V'Shalom, and the question is, should we be matter taking another wife or be matter giving her get without her, possible consent? Interesting shaila in the Chubas farm. There was a heter of, again, it's brought down in different variations, of 100 rabbanim in three countries of three kehillas. That was, and again, the different gersos, different sfarim are unclear. And that's the famous or infamous hetmer rabbanim, depending on which side you're on, beis hetmer rabbanim. Another machlokas rishonim was how long was that takana meant to be? Some rishonim bring that the takana was only meant to be for that elef, that thousand, that millennia of Jewish history. And b'meila, it became batel, something like the 1500s, 1400s. It's machlokas rishonim. Everybody is moda, even those who say that the takana itself is batel, once we're knowing like that, it has a status of a minute. But it does not have the status of a cherem and so on. That is a shaila in rishonim, whether or not that takana was meant to last forever or not. What makes this whole thing astounding, the Rush writes in his Tshuvas that there is no such thing as making a takana for Klal Yisrael that stopped with the end of the Bezna Gadol. And any community can have its own takanas, but another thing is a takana for Klal Yisrael. And the Rush says only somebody of the stature of Rabbi Negershom could possibly make such a takana, and that's kept. That's why it's true. It speaks to the Rebbe Negershom was the yachid that could do it. It could also be it probably was not a large community in Ashkenaz at the time, and he was the dominant figure. He was the Rebbe figure, and b'meila once that takana came in place, everyone else for it. But the Rush writes in it Zulas. Somebody asked him about takana from a community and so on, and he said there's no such thing as a cross community takana. A takana is local by definition, and except this is an extraordinary exception. So we have a takana of so we spoke about a takana of in Ishus, not having two wives, not giving get balkarcha. He has a takana not to remind about Tshuva's past. He has the famous chayrim not to read mail of somebody else, and people would sort of right on top of letters that they sent Cheren Rebbeinu Gershom, also of Tach Bechadrag. There's another interesting takana that he made that is historically important, not to be magia gemaris al pisvara. In other words, like this. A Sefer Torah, there are always mistakes creep in. People write, people are human, and they make a mistake. The only way in which we can keep Sefer Torah is correct is the Gemara says you go basarov. So if I find five Sefer Torah that have one nesach and two Sefer Torah another nesach, you go basarov. So Sefer Torah is relatively limited. It's done with great care when you write it. You have to even have in the Shemon and so on. So it's kept to some minimal. Gemaras are incredibly big. The Masechtas, forget about the Rishonim and everything, but the Gemaras themselves are incredibly big. And it's not written with the same intensity as the Sefer Torah. And inevitably, mistakes creep in. Now, how do I go about fixing them? There's a story, and again, I'm not putting it as a story too, but it's a cute story, that there was in the old days, Gemaras were scarce, and there was somebody in Brisk who would borrow Gemaras. You know, everybody borrowed Gemaras to learn. But this person would put in his comments on the side and sign his name off it. He came once, he needed a Masechta that wasn't around, and he asked Reb Chaim Brisk if he can borrow his Gemara. So he said, on one condition, no comments and no signing your name on the side. You know, none of that. So he said, okay. He got to a Mishnah. It says the Mishnah speaks about he is a chamar gomel. Chamar gomel means a donkey camel. It's words doesn't mean anything. What it means is it means as if somebody's being schlepped in two ways by a donkey and a camel. It's an Erev point. This person looked at it and he said, clear mistake. So he wrote on the side, Tzorach Loima Chamor Godel, and signed his name off on it. Or he didn't sign it. So he brought it back to Chaim Briska. He was very upset. And he said, once again, you did both things. You changed it and you signed your name, Chamor Godel. So it's, you know, that was, but it's very easy. So people would change Gersos. And this is something that sometimes it fixed it, sometimes it wreaked havoc. Because the person, whatever it is, if you want to take a look at how many Gersos down in Gemaras, there is a machon in Eretz Yisrael. They put out the Dukhi Sefer HaShalom, it's called. It has, I don't know how many sense they have, every possible Gersos. It's in the thousands. Most of them are very relevant. All the difference in different manuscripts. There's the Inlet of a Seif. So he made a takana not to be Magia Misvara. That seems to be, in other words, if you find different manuscripts that are more than the one you found, and if they override it, so they override it. But just because it doesn't make sense to you, you don't do it. If you'll take a look, the way that became in Kal Yisrael acceptable, if you take a look at something like the Marshal, who made a lot of Hagos and Gersos, he always writes them on the side. There's a little Aleph, a little this, and it's written on the side. They don't change inside, even if it's very clear. So any type of Haggah that's Misvara, they'll put on the side as a suggestion. Tosvis, Rashi also deals a lot with Gersos. The Gersos that Rashi writes usually become part of the Gemara. Most of the time you'll see it. It's not clear which came first, but it's obvious if Rashi is changing the Gersa, and we have this Gersa Rashi has, probably that's where it came. Tosfos will bring Gersos and talk about it. But it was not, there was a general Gershon to change actually in that. Yes?
What are the Hashivas of the Vilna Shah that we use? What is the, there was the Bamberg and the Basel, but somehow Vilna has become the
So the Vilna Shas was the nicest one. It was, first of all, aesthetically, it's the nicest. They also had good people working on it, which meant that there were less mistakes, there were more things in it, and the people who didn't like Vilna Shas, there was like a frum thing. They felt it was a little more modern, whatever, maskilish, you know, that was the flavor of it.
But it wasn't based on any story.
I don't believe that there was any big difference in that. They had more mefarshim. Everyone had their own mefarshim and haggos and so on and so forth. But that's it's interesting. When Frankel put out the Rambam, it was an incredible work. Person was Mashkia Kol Hoyin, and a really incredible work to Frank Rambam. One of the things he worked on was the different girsos. So he had three types of girsos. There was the very few that he actually changed the text inside, where all the manuscripts were not like the printed one, it was very clear from everything. He had those that he felt were very important, probably right, but not certainly, and those he wrote on the side. And then alternative girsos that may make sense, he put in the back. That was his thing. I think the system itself, he started in the second one. When he changed the Gersa inside, the Stipel took his name off it. He felt we should never, ever, even under all circumstances, as it is the status quo, leave it that way. He didn't want to dispute it, but he felt, we should. That's sort of a totso of that attitude, not to change the Gersa under any circumstance. Al-Kaponim. So let's just briefly review all the points. Rabbeinu Gershom was really at a pivotal point in Jewish history. The fact that we don't know much about him, but we know a lot. Rashi was a Talmud of a Talmud, and everyone referred to him as the Maor Gola. He was the one who created a system, and in many areas, that actually became the basis for Jewish community life. So it was and the fact that he, his pirush, the pirushim they wrote, whether him or talmidim or chaverim, that became the foundation for the new type of mefarsh, like Rashi primarily. That's like the first one. His the fact that he seemed to be such a strong figure in setting up communal life over there. His takanis in all the types, whether those takanis that withstood the test of history or not, and there's a lot of machlokas, which takanis are chayrim, which are not chayrim, which are meant to be for always, which are meant to be for always. But whatever it is, the takanis obviously put down Jewish communal life in Ashkenaz, as long as it was destined to survive, on very healthy foundations. It had to do with the economic interactions and the businesses and the fights and the machlokas and a lot of the takanis relate to different aspects of that. The fundamental takanis regarding Jewish family life, which seem very important, the ones about allowing people who did tshuva and came back to have a second start. It obviously was a very important point. It was a sore point. You know, your next door neighbor fries out and he becomes a Christian and he calls you names and he's going to church and that. And one day he comes to do tshuva, you have a feeling you'd like him to suffer a little bit. You know, maybe crucify him or something. But tachlis, he understood and that it's not, you know, we need to give people a chance to come back. And his kololos, and the very legacy that in Germany, takanis kehila were actually very, very strong. We don't have records in Sfarad of takanis a kehila that type. The tzura of a kehila with takanis and so on, we have a lot of pinkasei kehilas. This was the prototype for it, that a kehila arranges its affairs, makes takanis that keep the economic field level and good for everybody, and whatever else is needed for Jewish life. So it's sometimes like a building where you're impressed by the great building, but you understand that because of foundations that it has such a kiyum. And Rabbeinu Gershom was the foundation stone for Ashkenaz Jewry and B'nai Ashkenaz afterwards. Okay.